Hello and welcome to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. Delighted to be here with you and to have 2 hours with Jimmy Akin for an Ask Me Anything. I won't be giving out the phone number because it's an internet version of an Ask Me Anything. And that means I get to read the questions, but I also get to read the names because people give themselves nom de internet and they're fun to read. Jimmy Akin, of course, senior apologist here at Catholic Answers, the proprietor of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World, one of the most popular podcasts in the world, and of the newer podcast, the Jimmy Akin Podcast. Hello, Jimmy Akin.
Hello, Cy Kellett. How you doing?
I am doing very, very well. And when I say that the Mysterious World is one of the most popular podcasts, that consistently ranks in the top 10, top 20 of documentary podcasts?
Top 20, top 25. Yeah.
Yeah. There's hundreds and hundreds of episodes. So if you haven't heard all the mysteries, well, you're pretty good if you've heard all the mysteries. But if you haven't heard, check them out. There's a guaranteed to be a mystery for you. In more than 300 mysteries, there's guaranteed to be one for you. As I said, I won't be giving out the number because the questions are already in. And Jimmy, I think you added spaces to these names for me. I'm looking through them.
Yep.
And you're helping me pronounce them today. All right, well, we'll see if it helps. You never know. Let's start right in. Germ-Sil-3 wants to start us off. Here's the question. At what point do you think pursuing the rights in the Second Amendment becomes sinful?
Okay, so anytime we're talking about a text, it's helpful to review the text. So what the Second Amendment to the United States Constitution says is a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. So this is dealing with two rights, the right to keep arms, which means own them, and the right to bear arms, which means carry them around. And for a good bit of recent history, there was a question about what's all this stuff about a well-regulated militia and being necessary to the security of a free state. What does that mean? Today, and this is why this has come up in recent discussions, today the term militia is commonly used to refer to a military or paramilitary body that is organized has a distinct identity where, like, some people are parts of the militia and other people are not part of the militia. But as the Supreme Court pointed out in its Heller decision a few years ago, that is not what the term militia meant at the time the Second Amendment was drafted. And back then, the term militia referred to basically all adult males. So it was a synonym for all able-bodied adult males that could do military service, whether they were in the military or not. And so the idea was you need to have a well-regulated population of people who are fit for military service, so you don't want to abridge their rights to keep and bear arms. Also, what they meant by a free state, they didn't mean exactly what we mean, but I don't want to get too far into the weeds on that. Basically, what this guarantees is that the people shall have the right to keep arms, which means own them, and the right to bear them, which means carry them with them, not just lock them in a safe somewhere. So that gets us to Germ-Sil-3's question. At what point do I think that pursuing these rights would become sinful? Well, it depends on how you're pursuing the rights. One way of pursuing the rights is by advocacy. People go out and advocate for policies that they think are good. They criticize policies that they think are bad. And there are things that you could do in that kind of pursuit by advocacy that I think would be sinful. Like if you spent all your money pursuing advocacy of gun rights and you didn't reserve enough money to take care of the needs of you and your family and so forth, I think that would be sinful. You would be misusing your money in pursuit of this goal. So I think that would be one way that it could be sinful. Also, a lot of times when people are doing advocacy, they can adopt an attitude towards other people that is not loving. They can get hateful, in fact, in the rhetoric they use and in things they say about other people. They can dehumanize people they disagree with. And all of those actions are contrary to the ethic of universal love. You know, the second great commandment is love thy neighbor as thyself. And so in advocacy situations, we should not be directing hate towards our neighbor. We should be loving our neighbor, even if we disagree with our neighbor. So I think that's another way that pursuit by advocacy could be sinful. Then there's a whole other kind of pursuit, which is pursuit by ownership, by, you know, purchasing arms and so forth. What I'm not going to cover in this answer is misuse, like not knowing gun safety
and criminality
and things like that, and reckless endangerment and stuff, because all of those are misuse. Those are not rights. The rights are keeping the arms and bearing the arms. And so how could those become sinful? Well, one way is, again, financial. Because you could spend all your money on buying guns and, you know, gun products, and not devote money to other things that have more pressing uses, you know, like feeding your family or getting medical care or saving for the future and so forth. So again, there would be a kind of financial abuse that could become sinful. Also, there you could, without misusing the gun, you could display a lack of love for people in your family by prioritizing ownership of guns over taking care of your family needs. You also could bear arms in situations where it's going to escalate into violence unnecessarily. And you could bear arms in situations where it's going to free people out and make them unnecessarily afraid and things like that. You know, so I think there is potential to pursue the rights mentioned in the Second Amendment in a way that's sinful. But those would be my thoughts on some situations where that might occur.
All right, Germcil. Germcil 3. Apologies to Germcil 1 and 2. Thank you very much for the question. I like this name. Gosh darn it. Are there dinosaurs in the Bible?
Well, there are references in the Bible to creatures like Leviathan and Behemoth, and sometimes people will try to find modern animals that they think would correspond to Leviathan and Behemoth. The two proposals that I'm familiar with are Behemoth is supposed to be like a hippopotamus, and Leviathan, because it's referred to as a water-dwelling creature, is thought to be like a crocodile. Mm-hmm. But I think those are not accurate. I think that in the mind of the biblical author, these are not modern animals that we're familiar with. They're chaos monsters. And so the question then becomes, is there a basis for belief in chaos monsters? And I think the answer is yes, and it is connected with dinosaurs, because fossils are not new. By definition, they are old. And so people have been digging up fossils all the way through human history. Now, in the 1800s, an organized effort got, you know, to dig them up and study them got organized. And that led to the modern science of paleontology. But even before paleontology, there were people finding dinosaur bones all the way down through history. You know, even like St. Augustine, for example, talks about finding a tooth on a beach that was like 50 times the size of a regular tooth. So people all the way down through history have been finding dinosaur bones and drawn a entirely reasonable conclusion, which is, wow, these are giant monstrous bones. There must have been giant monsters living here in the past.
Right.
And they were right. And today we call those giant monsters dinosaurs. So I would say that the references to like Leviathan and Behemoth in the Bible, even though we don't have dinosaurs appearing on camera so to speak, are nevertheless based on dinosaurs, and so, or likely based on dinosaurs. And so I think it's fair to say that dinosaurs do kind of appear in the Bible, but not literally on camera. It's not like Moses hops on his brontosaurus and goes riding off.
I don't want to say the Bible can be improved on, but no, I don't.
It would be cool.
It would have been cool. All right, gosh darn it. Thank you very much for the question. Lots more questions to come. It's an Ask Me Anything with Jimmy Akin. All the questions are in from the internet. We'll get to more of them right after this on Catholic Answers Live.
Catch Catholic Answers Live anytime at Catholic.com.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects home buyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
Are you a coffee drinker? If so, you can now enjoy a coffee roasted to perfection by the Carmelite Monks of Wyoming. Delicious Mystic Monk coffee is roasted and prepared by monks in a hidden cloistered monastery and is available in over 25 varieties. All Mystic Monk coffees are works of perfection and labors of love. For more information on how to purchase Mystic Monk coffee, visit mysticmonkcoffee.com. That's mysticmonkcoffee.com.
Hi, this is Father Mike Schmitz. Please join me for Ascension's Bible in a Year and Catechism in a Year here on EWTN Radio. We're going through the entire Bible and the Catechism in 365 days. If you've ever wanted to understand what it means to be Catholic and allow those truths to shape your life, this is for you.
Bible in a Year and Catechism in a Year with Father Mike Schmitz. Tonight at 10 p.m. Eastern, 7 p.m. Pacific on EWTN Radio.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live, talking with Jimmy Akin. Both hours today, and we've got lots of great questions. And I know that because they're already in. They came from the internet. So lots of great questions, lots of great names of people who asked the questions. And this one's from Hank, King of Mischief, 4372. I can't believe there's that much need for a number after the name Hank, King of Mischief. But maybe you have to put a number. No, that doesn't make sense. This is a good question, Hank. How does the incarnation not defy divine simplicity?
Okay, so first thing we need to do is define what divine simplicity means. Well, divine means connected with God, and so then we just need to understand what simplicity is. And it, in philosophical and theological language, refers to the property of not having parts. So, for example, I'm Jimmy Akin. I have a body and a soul, so I am not simple. I have parts. One part of me is the part that is my body. Another part of me is the part that is my soul. Also, my body is not simple because my body has parts. You know, I've got a finger on this hand. I've got a finger on this hand. In fact, I've got five fingers on each hand. So I've got 10 body parts right there. And so my body has many parts, but thus it is not simple. It is complex or composite, however you want to say it. But the teaching of divine simplicity is that God is entirely simple. God does not have parts. And so you can't cut God up into different things. Well, okay, so that applies to the divine essence. And that's the key to answering Hank King of Mischief's question. What the doctrine of divine simplicity holds is that the divine essence itself is simple and has no parts. But the incarnation of Jesus goes beyond the divine essence, because that's what the incarnation is. It's where the second person of the Trinity took on a human nature. So in addition to his divine essence, the second person of the Trinity, or the Son, also took on a human spirit and a human body and all the parts that that human body is made out of. So the doctrine of divine simplicity is not violated because Jesus's divine essence remains simple. It has no parts. Now, when you add, though, the human spirit and the human body that Jesus also acquired at the incarnation, well, those are not simple, but divine simplicity is not violated because it only pertains to the divine essence. So the key is the divine essence remains simple in Jesus both before and after the incarnation. The incarnation is something that's added on top of the, if you want to use that if you want to use that preposition, but it's added on top of the absolutely simple divine essence that Jesus has. It's something in addition to that.
All right. I hope that answers your question, Hank, King of Mischief. Look forward to another question from you because I like reading the name. Arlo Brimley asks, if faith is a grace from God, why is not everyone given all the grace they need? In the parable of the sower, why isn't everyone made into good soil? Is it simply due to free will that even given all the grace in the world, some people, for whatever reason, would still say no? Thank you for your time, Mr. Aiken.
Okay, so faith is a grace from God, but the Catholic understanding is that everyone is given the grace that they need. Everyone is given sufficient grace for salvation. That doesn't mean that that it's going to be easy to do everything, but everyone is given the grace that they need. It's kind of like that Rolling Stones song. You can't always get what you want, but you may get what you need. And everybody in the Catholic understanding gets the grace they need. So we want to make that distinction. When it comes to the parable of the sower in particular, this parable is looked at differently in different schools of Christian thought. For example, in Calvinism, the parable of the sower is frequently understood in line with a Calvinist rejection of libertarian free will. So the idea would be that you just are a given type of soil, and when you hear the gospel, you will act accordingly. If you're the good soil, you're going to bring forth abundant fruit. If you're the soil that's choked by thorns, you're not. If you're, you know, and so forth, through the four different types of soil. And so Calvinists will tend to go to Matthew's version of this parable, and they will present it in line with Calvinist teaching that there are just these different types of soil that correspond to different types of people, and you have no control over which type of soil you are. And the reason they tend to go to Matthew's version of this parable rather than the version in Luke is Luke's got a clarifying comment. If you read Luke's explanation of the parable of the sower, where the disciples come to Jesus and say, so tell us, you know, what this parable means, and Jesus goes through it and he explains the different types of soil and how they correspond to different reactions to the gospel. He's got some additional remarks at the end, and in Luke 8:18, he says, take heed, therefore, how you hear, because he's been talking about people hearing the gospel. And so that would suggest that even though the parable describes four reactions that are analogized to four different types of soil, that it's not a given what type of soil you're going to be. What is a given is there are these four reactions, which we can symbolize with four different types of soil. But which reaction you personally have is going to depend on how you exercise your free will and whether you choose to listen to the gospel and give the good soil response, or whether you choose to ignore it, or like the birds that eat up the seeds, or whether you choose to let worldly cares choke you and not produce fruit and so forth. But it's ultimately down to your free will, and that comes out more clearly in Luke's version, which is why Calvinists tend not to quote Luke's version of this that much.
All right, Arlo, I hope that was helpful to you. It was a very good question. Thank you. This one comes from Jeremy. With what level of certainty can we say where someone is in the afterlife apart from extraordinary means like canonization? Secondly, what are good ways to communicate this appropriate level of certainty to those grieving the loss of someone they love? All right, Jeremy.
Well, so we can't say with certainty, but based on the evidence a person's life gives, we can make an estimate of what, you know, at least some kind of an estimate of where a person may end up in the afterlife. Did they die in God's friendship or not? Did they end up in a way that they would need to have some purification before they end up in heaven and so forth? So we can get an approximate estimate using the same criteria that are given to us in the New Testament for knowing our own salvation. If you look in John's epistles, for example, he talks about how no one, you know, God is love, and no one who loves God hates his neighbor. Therefore, if we see evidence of love of God and neighbor in a person's life, then we can say, okay, this person, you know, it looked like they were fulfilling the two great commandments, and so they're likely to have a good fate. This is all the more the case if they're, you know, a baptized believing Catholic and so forth. But even if they're not a baptized believing Catholic, if they display evidence of love of God and love of neighbor, even if they have their flaws, then fundamentally we have reasons for optimism. What I would not recommend doing if you see no evidence of love of God and neighbor in someone, like if someone was a total psychopath in life and they did malicious things all the time to other people, I wouldn't tell someone, well, your loved one is probably in hell, because I don't know that the person is in hell. I can't judge another person's heart. Maybe they were suffering under some kind of psychological condition that impeded them from being able to function as a loving person. And so I can't say what degree of responsibility they had for their outward actions, even if their outward actions were bad. So I wouldn't tell, for example, Mrs. Adolf Hitler, you know, whose name was Eva Braun, I wouldn't tell her, you know, I think your husband is probably in hell. Now, of course, she actually committed suicide before he did. So, I wouldn't be telling her that anyway, but supposing she had survived Hitler, I wouldn't tell her your husband's probably in hell. I would say something softer, like your husband is now in God's hands and God is merciful and understands, you know, your husband more fully than anyone can in this life, and we must leave his fate up to God. So that's how I would address a negative situation. Picking Hitler, obviously, because he's a really negative guy. But if I'm not dealing with a negative situation, I'll be even more positive. But fundamentally, I personally am unlikely to canonize anybody, but I, you know, even informally in my speech, but I would, you know, be happy to say things like your loved one is now with God, which is true. Even, you know, they met God and at the particular judgment, and I would point out, you know, despite whatever quirks he had, your loved one displayed signs of love of God and love of neighbor, and all of that's positive. That speaks well for his situation in the afterlife. And so I don't think we can have a great degree of certainty here, but in communicating with a grieving person, like the Andrew sisters say, you want to accentuate the positive and eliminate the negative in how you're presenting the data, because when someone's grieving is not really the time for a cold clinical look, but to offer a warm, compassionate look given the facts that are on the table.
Jeremy, thanks very much for the question. Lots of questions for Jimmy this hour. You also tackle mysteries of the faith now on the Jimmy Akin podcast. What kind of stuff do you tackle on the Jimmy Akin podcast?
Well, it varies from week to week. And I look at a lot of different things. Sometimes I do reaction videos to things other people have said. Sometimes I answer questions that that listeners and viewers have sent in. Sometimes I respond to other apologists. Sometimes I take on particular topics. Like, I've been exploring actually issues like grace and free will and predestination and stuff like that in different episodes. So it really varies, but anything that's connected with the faith is fair game on that podcast. So there's a lot of stuff to cover.
Check it out. You can go to Jimmy's YouTube channel. Lots and lots of stuff at Jimmy's YouTube channel. You can also get Mysterious World and the Jimmy Akin podcast wherever you get your podcasts. We got to take a very quick break. Hey, all this year, Society 315 has given out the Halo app to every new member. If you want to check it out, go to casociety315.com or just Google Catholic Answers Society 315. Right back with more questions for Jimmy on Catholic Answers Live. We hope that one of the things that we communicate here at Catholic Answers Live is that our Catholic faith allows us to be fully serious about all the problems we encounter in the church and in the world, but it also lets us have light hearts and maybe even mix in a bit of fun. And that is exactly what our good friend Joe Heschmeyer does in his popular podcast, Shameless Popery. You should check it out at shamelessjoe.com. Joe's got a deep grasp of the faith, of morals, the teachings of the church, all that. But he's also got a witty conversational style. He entertains and he informs. But you will leave equipped to better answer the most common challenges, misconceptions, and questions about the Catholic faith. He's got insightful guests. He does on-air debates. And he takes a close look into all the things that you want to know about as a Catholic living today. You'll walk away knowledgeable and filled with joy. Look for Joe on his YouTube channel. Check him out at shamelessjoe.com or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you like what you hear, become a patron.
Deepen your connection to the Church's holy days and seasons while you draw on the wisdom of the Church Fathers. Feasts of Our Fathers, the new book from Mike Aquilina and Adam Lucas, is a treasury of history, prayers, insights, and lessons that will bring you closer to the earliest of Catholic traditions. Take your prayer life and your solidarity with the Church, past and present, to a new level. Order your copy of Feasts of Our Fathers today at shop.catholic.com.
When the resurrected Jesus appeared to disciples on the road to Emmaus, they didn't recognize him until the breaking of the bread. The same is true today. In the Holy Eucharist, we really meet Jesus. In The Eucharist is Really Jesus, author Joe Heschmeyer explains how knowing Jesus in the Eucharist is the key to understanding all of Christian faith. Order your copy of The Eucharist is Really Jesus today at shop.catholic.com or get it at a good Catholic bookstore. Little bit of groovy music for you. Jimmy Akin, our guest. It's Ask Me Anything. All the questions are in already. They've come from the internet. We have Jimmy interacts with lots and lots of people on the internet and gathers up questions for us to do these shows. And it's nice because people don't always have the opportunity to call the show. Sometimes it's on when they're off. So to speak, like sleeping or working or something, or they're not available. So that's awful nice. But also, it's just nice to give all the people who interact with Jimmy on the internet a chance to ask their questions. This one comes from Jeremy. No, I just did Jeremy. This one, this one comes from Bill. I travel quite a bit. Missing Mass and days of obligation happens, unfortunately. Should I seek a dispensation from my pastor? What should my approach be?
Well, you're not. So I would say there are sort of two things here. The first one is if your travel schedule is such that you're genuinely not able to make it to Mass on a Sunday or a holy day of obligation, then you simply do not have an obligation on that day. The Church understands that there can be reasons for missing Mass, and having a work schedule or a travel schedule that, you know, would make it you know, very difficult to get to Mass, if not impossible, is something that's a legitimate excuse for missing Mass. It's not desirable, but it's something that does happen. And so the church understands that, and you don't have an obligation on those days. There is, though, a spectrum here between absolutely impossible to make it to Mass and unreasonably difficult to get to Mass. If either of those are the case, then, well, you just don't have an obligation. But that spectrum, you know, covers ground of getting easier and easier to get to Mass, where even though you're traveling, there might be a Mass at a convenient time for you right at a church right across the street from the hotel. And so it actually might be easy for you to go to Mass in that situation. And if it's easy, well, then you wouldn't be excused. And so you would need to go if it's a situation where there's an easy way for you to get to Mass. And these days, you know, we have things like masstimes.org, where you can look up Mass times for any parish in the United States and find out where they are easily. So, you know, it's, knowledge is not as restricted as it used to be, or it's not as difficult to get knowledge of when masses are available in whatever location you're going to be at. So somewhere in between these is a point that there's no way to objectively determine where it's ambiguous, where, you know, where does it tip from you're excused to you're not excused? You know, where is that in the middle of this spectrum? And there's no way to interpret that objectively. And so you just got to make your best guess. But the church has a backup for that, which is the fact that your pastor can give you a dispensation. And so if you're not sure whether or not you're clearly exempt, then you can ask your pastor for a dispensation. You could even do that preemptively and say, you know, here's my work situation or here's my travel situation. Can you dispense me from future occasions where this occurs? He also doesn't have to fully remove it. He can also commute it to something else. So like I've had situations where I had something going on the weekend and it was going to make it very hard for me to go to Mass. And I went to my pastor and, you know, because travel was involved, I was like trying to drive across the country in 2 days over a weekend. And when you're doing that, finding a parish on the way that is going to be having Mass when you're in that town at, you know, if you're driving, and not having to just chill and hang out for hours waiting for the Mass to occur, you know, I was probably excused anyway. But just to be safe, I went to my pastor and said, you know, I'm not trying to get out of going to a Mass. I'm happy to go to another Mass later in the week, for example. Could you dispense or commute my obligation this week? And in this particular case, he commuted it and said, yeah, when you get back from your trip, just go to Mass during the week, and it was no problem. So you might be able to go to your pastor and say, and it has to be your pastor. It can't be, you know, so, or it could be your bishop, but it needs to be at least your pastor, not an assistant priest. And say, here's my situation. Can we work out some kind of situation for doubtful cases in the future where I could either be dispensed or I could be commuted for, well, when you get back, you know, go to an extra Mass or something like that?
Bill, what an interesting question. Thanks very much. On we go. It's Ask Me Anything. Jimmy Akin, our guest. This one comes from SVE155. I understand that the law of the conservation of mass applies to chemical reactions. However, when considering the bodily assumption of our Blessed Mother and the ascension of Jesus into heaven, how is the law of conservation of mass applied? I understand that heaven isn't somewhere else, but somehow else. Then how is mass converted between our physical realm to the spiritual realm where our Lord and Lady exist?
Well, we don't know. So the law of conservation of mass and energy, because mass and energy are the same thing, just in different forms, is something that has been observed to apply in our universe, at least since the Big Bang. It does not look like mass is either created or destroyed. At least we don't find that happening. You could quibble with that, because there are, you know, quantum particles that pop into existence and then pop right back out again, but those are not held as violating the law of conservation of mass. Fundamentally, it doesn't look like since creation that that new mass and energy has been created in our universe. But if heaven is a separate realm that's not part of our physical universe, which would seem to be the case, then what laws apply there, we don't know. It could be that conservation of mass and energy does not apply in heaven. And so, you know, if you have a physical body that is in heaven, it might gain mass and energy, you know. So it could be that that ongoing creation of mass and energy still occurs there. We don't know, because we don't know what physical laws apply there, if any. It does seem that physical bodies, that heaven is at least capable of receiving physical bodies in some form, because we know Jesus has his body with him, Mary has his body, her body with her, and so forth. We don't know if they're physically extended in space in three dimensions the way they would be in this world, because we don't know how the dimensionality of heaven works. So it's possible that they're there, but they're not manifest the way that they would be here in our world. We just have to leave all of that up to God. One thing I would say, though, is the conservation of mass and energy applies to particular domains, even within our universe. And it's not violated if you transfer something from one domain to another. For example, conservation of mass and energy applies here on Earth. So here on Earth, there is not new mass being created or destroyed. And similarly, on Mars, there's not new mass being created or destroyed. But that doesn't stop rocket ships from sending things between Earth and Mars. So you could take some mass here on Earth, let's say fashion it into a Viking probe, stick it on a rocket, shoot it over to Mars, and now there's a Viking probe on Mars. Well, all that matter came from Earth, but the law of conservation of mass and energy is not violated, because all you've done is move the mass from one domain to another. And in the same way, if Mary or Jesus takes their body with them to heaven, then that wouldn't appear to violate the conservation of mass, regardless of the laws of physics that apply in this other realm. As long as it's capable of receiving mass and energy, it would appear that all you've done is just transfer the mass and energy of Jesus or Mary's body from one domain, namely our universe, to heaven. And so it doesn't appear to me that there's any violation of this law in place, but ultimately we don't know if this law applies or how it applies to heaven, but at least on the face of it, I'm not seeing evidence for a violation of this law here.
SVE 155, thank you. Excellent question. We're going to take a quick break. Jimmy Akin is our guest. It's Ask Me Anything, both hours today on Catholic Answers Live.
This is Archbishop Paul Coakley, the Archdiocese of Oklahoma City, and you're listening to Catholic Answers Live.
Who was the first Catholic in your family? Were they evangelized by a friend, a coworker, a stranger? Did you ever think that you could be that person that God uses to save a soul, and that soul could save their family, their grandchildren, and generations to come? At St. Paul Street Evangelization, a Catholic nonprofit, we train, equip, and mobilize Catholic disciples to do the urgent work of evangelization. Catholic Answers is supported in part by St. Paul Street Evangelization, streetevangelization.com.
This is Jim Pinto, Director of EWTN Media Missionaries. EWTN's mission is to spread the eternal word and to teach others that Jesus Christ is the way, the truth, and the life. you can help EWTN share the good news by becoming a media missionary. Visit EWTNmissionaries.com today and join us in sharing the eternal word with the world.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Jimmy Akins, our guest this hour and next. And all the questions are in. Peter asked this. Wait, am I? Yeah, I'm on the right question. I'm sorry. How does one justify or condemn the use of nuclear weapons? More specifically, how do you weigh the deaths of Japanese children against the potential deaths of American soldiers? And then Peter put in parentheses, from a Catholic perspective.
Okay, so the first thing is I'm not going to take a position that says all use of nuclear weapons is wrong. There will be some folks who do that, but I don't see that, because nuclear weapons are just weapons, and there are legitimate uses for weapons that exist. And a nuclear weapon is just a particularly large and powerful weapon, but that doesn't change the nature of it. And so if you have a sufficiently important military goal that it would be legitimate to use other weapons for, and then you could potentially use a nuclear weapon for it. There are also non-nuclear uses for or non-military uses for nuclear weapons that are legitimate. Like if an asteroid were approaching Earth and the best way to deal with the asteroid was to deflect its course by setting off a nuclear bomb in its path, that would be so that the shockwave diverts it, that would be legitimate. Or if you want to use a Orion class spaceship, or maybe it's Daedalus, I'd have to look it up. If you let's say we had an alien invasion, this is actually the plot of the novel Footfall by Jerry Niven and Larry Pornell. But if we had an alien invasion and we needed to fight the aliens in space with the technology we have available today, it would be legitimate. I guess this would be a military use, but not in the way you think. It would be legitimate to build a starship powered by nuclear weapons, where what you do is you put a big plate on the back of the starship, and then behind that, you set off a chain of nuclear weapons, and the shockwave pushes the spaceship forward. And in fact, even if we didn't have an alien invasion, you could use that to get up to an appreciable speed, fraction of the speed of light, and go to another star system. That would be a non-military use of nuclear bombs. So there are morally legitimate uses, but what about their use in wartime? Peter asks, how do you weigh the deaths of Japanese children against the potential deaths of American soldiers from a Catholic perspective? And the answer is, you don't. Japanese children are civilians, and so you can't weigh the deaths of children against American soldiers and say it's okay to kill, you know, this number of Japanese children in order to save this number of American soldiers. American soldiers are combatants. And so you can compare their deaths to the deaths of other combatants. You could say, okay, we have these American soldiers and these Japanese soldiers. What way of using weaponry, whether nuclear or not, will help us achieve the battle goal with the minimum loss of human life on both sides? But you can't just justify children as part of that, because or American civilians, because they're not combatants and they're in a different category. Now, what you could do is tolerate the deaths of civilians, whether children or not, if there's a proportionate military goal. Like a classic example would be, let's suppose, again, in a World War II context, let's suppose you're planning a bombing raid over Germany, let's say, and let's say you're going to bomb a military munitions factory that the Nazis are relying upon in order to get weaponry to use against the Allies. Okay, that's a legitimate military goal. But suppose that the Nazis have put a night watchman in this building. He's a civilian. He's not a combatant. And you could tolerate the death of a night watchman as because he's not your target. Your target is a military thing. It's the munitions plant. And you can tolerate the death of the night watchman, or let's say someone who lives right across the street from the military plant, as collateral damage. Provided the value of the military target is sufficient, you can accept civilian collateral damage. And, you know, it's a fairly straightforward, although in practice sometimes elusive, moral calculus about, well, how much collateral damage can be justified for by this target. But in principle, you can say, yeah, we're going to save a bunch of lives by taking out this military plant. That's our target. We're not trying to kill the civilians. We're not targeting the civilians. We're just tolerating the deaths of a few civilians in order to do this big, important military thing. Well, hypothetically, you could do that with a nuclear bomb. You could, for example, I remember thinking up one hypothetical example in the War on Terror, that, you know, Osama bin Laden was a big, important military target. He was hiding somewhere in the valleys of Afghanistan, and we had a pretty good idea which valley. And hypothetically, someone could say, okay, he's a very high-value military target. We could use a small nuke in that situation, in this environment where not a lot of other people are going to be killed, but we're going to be able to take out this very high value target. Hypothetically, something like that would be possible. But notice, it's the target is military. The target is not civilian. It is never legitimate to target civilians. And so their deaths can at most be tolerated. And that does not comport with the target and selection criteria that the United States used in World War II with the nuclear bombs. The two nuclear devices that were used ultimately at Hiroshima and Nagasaki were specifically targeted at cities, and cities are with large populations, in order to create what later would be called shock and awe in the Japanese hierarchy. And so in those cases, civilians were deliberately targeted. And therefore, even though I can envision situations where the military use of nuclear weapons could be legitimate, this was not a pair of legitimate uses. And you cannot say, oh, we saved more lives by killing Japanese children and civilians, and that justified what we did. No, you cannot do that. You can never target civilians. You can only target military objectives, and targeting a whole city does not fall into that category. Saying we're going to wipe out this city and its people in order to put pressure on the Japanese, that's not morally legitimate. And what we did in those two cases was not morally legitimate.
Peter, thank you. Great question. Appreciate it very much. I've got a few minutes left, and I can get another question in. Freehouse 11 wants to know this. Would Jesus's family be considered poor compared to the average family in Nazareth? If so, would that have something to do with not being able to find a room at the inn in Bethlehem?
Well, the truth is, in the ancient world, most people were poor. And so it's not surprising that Jesus's family was poor. I don't have an objective, you know, study I could point you to that would address the question of, were Jesus's family more poor than the average family in Nazareth? I don't know that anyone has tried to compute the wealth of the median first century Nazareth family. But I wouldn't think they were that unusual. Nazareth was a very small community, and it was correspondingly a poor community. And so I don't have any basis for saying that Jesus' family was more poor than the average family from Nazareth at the time. When it comes to not having room at the inn in Bethlehem, that's a completely different subject. If Mary and Joseph had been rich, you know, if they had been rolling in wealth, and if they stopped at a hotel, then and that was already full up, they might have been able to bribe the hotelier into kicking someone else out to make room for them, or they might have been able to bribe the hotelier into just squeezing them in, because it's possible, and I've heard it, although I haven't verified it, that in a lot of inns, they didn't have private rooms. They just put you all in one communal space, and they might have been able to squeeze you in. But I don't think either one of those is what's actually going on. I think this is a persistent mistranslation in contemporary English translations of the Bible. The word that gets translated in Greek is kataluma. And kataluma means dwelling place. It does not mean an inn where you go and purchase space to rent. It's not like a motel or hotel or something like that. In fact, later in Luke, we see the same word appear when Jesus is planning the Last Supper. And he says to Peter and John, go into town, follow this guy. He'll take you to a house. When you get to the house, go in and say to the homeowner, where is the kataluma where I and my disciples are going to eat Passover? And he'll show you a large furnished kataluma. So this referred to a type of room within a house. It's the living room. You might put it that way, the room where people dwell. The way that first century Jewish houses tended to be constructed, they tended to be two-story, and people lived on the upper story, and then they kept their animals on the lower story. And so the natural understanding of what Luke says is that there was no room in the dwelling area where up on the second floor where the humans were. So Mary laid her firstborn son in a manger down on the first floor where the animals were kept. So that's where the manger would be. So I don't think that their inability to find room in the inn had anything to do with their wealth. I think they were actually at family property that the broader family owned, and they, because of the enrollment that was going on, they simply had too many people in the living room, in the upstairs dwelling area, and so they went to the lower area to lay Jesus in a manger as a crib. If you'd like more information about that, I did a video on it in the Jimmy Akin podcast. It's episode 15 called No Room at the Inn. And I go through and show you pictures of the type of houses they had and give you other biblical verses and so forth. So check out episode 15 of the Jimmy Akin podcast for more information about that.
All right. Free House, thanks very much. Miscellaneous 2160 says this: I don't know if this counts as normal or weird, but I've started to get into linguistics, and I was wondering how we should think of the Tower of Babel story. Thanks.
Well, so as Miscellaneous may know, the Tower of Babel narrative from Genesis is often used as a base text when translating stuff into a new language. It's kind of a model text that gets used since it involves the origin of languages. In terms of what to think of it, in terms of its historicity, well, it's in the first 11 chapters of Genesis, and as Pope Pius XII and many Bible scholars have noted, those are written in a different way than later history is. In Pius XII's terminology from his 1950 encyclical Humanae Generis, those 11 chapters convey historical truths, but in a way that uses simple and metaphorical language. So it's not straight history. It incorporates metaphor. And so I would say that the Tower of Babel story reflects that mankind is divided by language, and that this division of languages occurred under God's providence. But I wouldn't look at this text, the Tower of Babel, as telling us a literal story that occurred, but it's teaching us things that do pertain to real history, but in a metaphorical way.
Thanks, Miscellaneous 2160. Hey, we got a whole hour more of Internet Ask Me Anything with Jimmy Akin. We've got a whole bunch of great questions coming up. So hang on. We'll get right back to it right after this on Catholic Answers Live.